Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Scott Stossel with us. He is the author of Sarge, The Life and Times of Sergeant Shriver. He's the deputy director of The Atlantic Magazine. His articles and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, The New York Times, and many other publications. And let's say, Scott, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The Life and Times of Sergeant Shriver, my goodness, that must have been an epic for you in and of itself to go back, get the information, and put it to pen. What is it about Shriver, through all of your research, all of your study, everything that you've done, what was the one thing that stood out for you that caused you to see that this man was more than just a name?
Well, it's hard to boil it down to one thing, but if you had to, I mean, it was his tremendous energy and optimism. These were traits that infused everything that he did, from the things he's most famous for, such as starting the Peace Corps and launching the War on Poverty under Lyndon Johnson, and starting things like Head Start and Legal Services for the Poor and VISTA and Job Corps and all kinds of programs that still exist today, and also helping JFK run his presidential campaign and then staff his cabinet in 1960 and 61, and then helping his wife, Eunice Kennedy, start and run the Special Olympics, and his work in nuclear disarmament, and then going way back to the 50s, his work in civil rights in Chicago and on the school board there. I mean, this was a guy who had sort of this, you know, incredible energy, and a lot of that stemmed from his devout Catholic faith. And I think a lot of it he got from his mother too, who is not only a devout Christian but also an ardent Democrat from his childhood way back in the 1920s. And this was just a guy who, any task that was presented to him, no matter how many experts told him it was impossible, would say, who cares what the experts say? Nothing is impossible. And I interviewed hundreds of people for this, the book, and a lot of everyone from Arnold Schwarzenegger, his son-in-law, to a lot of his former aides and employees who went on to become cabinet members in the Clinton administration and do other greatly accomplished things, and they all said that he kind of changed their worldview and, as one of his old colleagues put it, expanded the horizons of the possible, which meant that changed their sense of what was achievable in this world. And this is the kind of spirit that he represented.
So really, if we wanted to define him, and if we wanted an overarching theme, it was a very powerful driving force. And everything that you mentioned that he created or started was something to help someone. And I think that's really what it comes down to. The man had a glow about him, and it was one of those kind of a glows that if he sparked you, you were on board and you moved with it. And there's a lot of power within that. Have we lost that today? And not getting left to right, I'm not concerned about that. But have we lost that today in our political realm?
It's interesting. People ask me that a lot. And I mean, I think to some degree we have. And partly that's, largely probably that's a function of the times that we live in. Obviously, the last few years have seen, horrible economic constraints placed on the horizons of the possible. And we've got political gridlock. And obviously, over the last 10 years, we've all lived, under the shadow of the threat of global terror, and things have become sort of more partisan and extreme, and this has been disheartening to a lot of people. Whereas when Sergeant Shriver kind of came of political age, he was in the late 50s and early 1960s, just at the moment when Eisenhower was kind of giving way to JFK and this whole sort of new generation of, these were all young World War II veterans who were coming back with energy, enthusiasm, and they were all kind of infused with the notion that, just the world could be improved, both through the private sector but also through government, and that the world could be made a better place. Nowadays, a lot of people of my generation, I'm sort of a Generation Xer, you say that and you just sound hopelessly naive to even say that. The words kind of almost stick in your throat. But for members of Shriver's generation, they'd just come out of World War II where they'd defeated Hitler, they'd defeated totalitarianism, they'd defeated evil. They'd come out of the Depression and seen how the New Deal had lifted millions of Americans from poverty and given them hope. So they were sort of infused with this sense that almost anything was possible. And so partly it was a function of the times they lived in, and the times are very different now. Obviously we went from the early 60s when there was all this hope and all these government programs being started to the late 60s when everything sort of broke down in riots and social disorder and then Vietnam, obviously. And here we are, you know, 30 or 40 years after that, and things are even tougher. But, you know, partly Shriver's spirit as an individual, I mean, he shows what an individual can accomplish even when the odds are arrayed against them. I mean, time after time, things were presented to him, and the political commentariat would say this can't be done, or, you know, he was a Democrat, and there would be, you know, ardent, both Republican and then Southern Democrat opposition to what he was doing, and he would just sort of, through force of charisma and personal charm, you know, get 100,000 kids into Head Start the first summer in 1965. And so I think, you know, to answer your question, yeah, it is, it's a very different time now, and I think there's a hunger for the sort of idealism and optimism and notion that, you know, you can actually change things through hard work and application. I don't think it's completely dead. And if he, you know, he passed away last year, if he were still around now, he would say, of course it's not dead. We just need to reawaken it. It's sleeping.
Scott, let me tell you what I see. And I'm a product of the 40s and 50s. I was born, early 40s, 1942. So I was brought up in the 50s. That's where, though, my formative years. And I'm on the between page 481 and where all the pictures are in the middle of the book. And what I'm saying is, if you were to describe him through my eyes and what I'm seeing here, you see America. You see the definition of what a good, strong, an American was in those days. And you see all these things that we stood for and the pride and everything else that went along with it. And I don't think we see that today. I think if anything else, that's what he stands for. He stands for the definition of what America had been and really should be at this moment in time.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And he had deep American roots. His ancestors had been here and were, you know, signatories to the Declaration of Independence and involved in sort of the early founding of Maryland. But beyond that, you know, he always strongly believed, and this, again, partly came from his religious faith, but largely came from kind of his civic beliefs that he inherited from his mother and just from kind of growing up in the time and among the people that he did, that this notion of public service and the idea of, you know, we are all called to serve. And, you know, myself, I'm not a particularly religious person, and I'm sort of an agnostic. So I was always, you know, when writing the book, it was hard for me to kind of project myself into his mindset with his deep Catholic faith. But it's inspiring nonetheless, because it's this idea that, you know, you should always be doing something to serve your country. You know, he did that fighting in World War II in the Navy, you know, to serve, your fellow man, to serve in particular. And this is partly a Christian idea, but one that I think we can all identify with and would do well to adopt, you know, to serve the less fortunate than ourselves. I mean, that this is a theme that runs through everything that he did. I mean, the Peace Corps was founded to help the kind of the poorest in foreign countries around the world. A lot of the programs in the War on Poverty were established to help the poorest and least fortunate among us here in this country. And then when he founded the Special Olympics with his wife, this was to help the mentally handicapped, mentally disabled. And he truly believed that, you know, the future of mankind, if we're to really become our best selves, was not to be, you know, through the Julius Caesars or the Eisenhowers or certainly the evil dictators of the world, sure, who you know, Napoleon, who governed through power, but through, you know, coming together to help the less fortunate. And for him, again, like I said, it had a very sort of Christian thing to it, but it's very American too, that we are all, and he was from the private sector. He believed in individual initiative and you know, an ardent believer in capitalism, but that we are all sort of in this predicament of life together and that we're duty bound to kind of come together and serve each other. So it was this idea of public service was very powerful throughout his life. And as you say, it's a very American idea.
Sure. And when you come down to it, there's the picture of September, what was it, 13th, 1965, Newsweek, The War on Poverty. I think poverty in 1965 carried a completely different definition than poverty is today. If you look at this man, I think what this man says is, if you're having a problem, we will help you. But once we help you, get on your feet and move forward, because we have all the tools here to help you do so. That's something I think that we're lacking today. Today, if you're having a problem, you stay down there, we'll support you, and then, you know, boat my way. I think things are completely different than they were in those days. But, you know, being religious, being agnostic, being an atheist, whatever the case may be, the point of contention is if you care about your fellow man, you're taking a look at the book. And by the way, thank goodness you don't charge by the pound. You'd never be able to afford this book. But if you take a look at it, and it says, you too can do this. That's what I see in his face. And every one of the pictures that you have here, it is a very good example of you want it, go get it, because it's here.
Right. And to your point about the idea of his notion of helping poverty in the 1960s, I mean, there's this sort of misconception about the war on poverty that it was like the beginning of the welfare state, or that it was creating dependency. Shriver was always opposed to that, and what he always said, when he started the war on poverty and through the 3 or 4 or 5 years that he was running it, he said, this is not about handouts. This is about a hand up. We're going to give you the tools that you need to get started in life, or if you're already farther along in life and are having a hard time, to kind of get you out of the trough and to push you on your way. But it's basically, trying to give you the initiative and empower you to do it yourself. And it is not meant to be, a permanent set of handouts or anything like that. So I think that's true. And that all kind of got distorted by the politics of the late 60s and 70s. His notion of both poverty but also what to do about it was different than the kind of particularly the right wing caricature of what liberal social programs is.
Scott, when you come down to it, when somebody decides to put something to pen, and it really doesn't matter what the subject matter is, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, during the process of the writing, there is that aha moment, that epiphany when you get into the writing and you realize something that you hadn't realized before, that was the dimension of the subject matter that went way beyond what you thought was there. Where was that for you in this?
Well, I'd say there were two points. One was very early on. I mean, I worked on the book for a very long time. It was about 7 years of research and reporting and writing. But one of the earliest moments, I mean, when I first started working on the project, I knew dimly who Sergeant Shriver was. I knew he was related to the Kennedy family. I knew he'd been active in American public life and had been a politician, but I didn't realize the full scope of his story. And so I went out to start interviewing him in way back in 1997, and we were sitting there at his home out in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and he was telling me this story about basically this harrowing story about when he was in all these battles in the South Pacific during World War II, when he was on the battleship, the USS South Dakota. And he just, he commanded a gunnery gun battery on the USS South Dakota, and they were fighting the Japanese. And I mean, as he was telling me these stories, just these horrific stories about seeing it, his friends, sort of blown apart by these Japanese kamikaze pilots, and about what he endured on those nights. My first revelation was, oh my God, this isn't just a boring political book. This is an amazing, sort of page turning American story. And this guy's an American hero. And that was the moment early on. At that point, I was still like, boy, do I have it in me to put in all the time that it would take to write a book of this length and scope. And at that moment, I sort of decided, wow, this guy's story is so interesting. The second kind of nickel that dropped for me about, what the depth and dimension of this story was as I got further into the reporting, that bit about him being, he was the sister, or his sister was Eunice Kennedy, or his wife was Eunice Kennedy, who was the sister of President Kennedy. So he, by marrying Eunice Kennedy, daughter of Joseph P. Kennedy, was marrying into the Kennedy clan. And, I knew that as a fact. I hadn't realized what a sort of complex relationship that would become, and how it would kind of change his political trajectory and make everything, both more complicated and more interesting, and in some ways more fulfilling. So, back in the 1950s in Chicago, everyone assumed Shriver was going to become governor of Illinois, or possibly a U.S. senator, and then maybe become president from there, or at least have a platform to campaign, because he had so much charisma and people were so impressed with what he could do. And then he married Eunice Kennedy, and he sort of at that point had to kind of yoke his star to the bright constellation of the Kennedys, and from that point forward he was always kind of having to subordinate his own political ambitions to theirs. And so it's interesting talking to many of his old friends. I mean, a lot of the ones who knew him back in Chicago thought, Shriver in marrying into the Kennedy family was sort of striking this Faustian bargain, that he was going to from that point forward always have to put their priorities and political goals ahead of his. And in fact, that's the case. There's in my book, I talk about time and time again where the kind of various factions in the Kennedy family would derail his own ambitions. I mean, Lyndon Johnson wanted to put him on the vice presidential ticket in 1964, and Bobby Kennedy and his people blocked it. Again, in 1968, Hubert Humphrey wanted to make him the vice president, and Ted Kennedy and some members of the Kennedy family basically blackballed him and said, you know, you'll lose the Kennedy wing of the party, Humphrey, if you do this. And then when Shriver himself contemplated a run for president briefly in 1976, the Kennedy family didn't even endorse him. So from one point of view, the Kennedy family was always forever holding him back and thwarting his goals. But from another perspective, you know, it was JFK who tapped Shriver to start the Peace Corps. And if he hadn't been in that role, then Lyndon Johnson would never have picked him to run the war on poverty. And if he hadn't been married to Eunice, he never would have, you know, together with Eunice, started the Special Olympics. So the balance sheet is long on both sides. There's all kinds of, you know, amazing programs that he started because of his connection to the Kennedy family, and then all kinds of, you know, what might have been that you can consider because the Kennedy family could kind of get in his way. But that just added a kind of richness and complexity to the story. It's almost this like Shakespearean saga of family rivalry, but also common cause, because they all had very similar political goals and aspirations and ideals. So it was those two things that kind of, for me, really enriched and deepened the story and made me realize, you know, this is not going to be a boring policy book, but something that has, you know, all kinds of human drama in addition to important bits of policy history.
Yeah, now the one thing, we're starting to run out of time now, but the one thing I would say, if there's anything to genetics, and if Maria got anything that her father had, if I was Schwarzenegger, I'd be real careful.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I had a fun time interviewing Governor Schwarzenegger right before he ran for governor in 2002 or 2003 about the book. It was, and that was quite an amusing conversation, I have to say.
Oh, I bet it was. Now, we're about out of time. Scott, do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
You can go to Amazon and get it, and I have a link, I think, up on my Twitter feed at S. Stossel. That's at S-S-T-O-S-S-E-L, and then you can go to The Atlantic Magazine, www.theatlantic.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Scott, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Mexico, Sweden, good night. Hawaii, Japan, and Capri.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it is, and what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Karen Glick with us. She's the author of Questions in the Silence. Dr. Karen Glick is a clinical psychologist in the Philadelphia area. who has been in practice for more than 20 years now. She also does work as a voice actress and is the founder of the Bella Luna Voice Company. She's recorded relaxation exercises and meditation practices for clients, as well as directed patients in psychodramatic productions and has recorded audiobooks. And again, her first novel is Questions in the Silence. And let us say, Karen High, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael Ray.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we talk questions in the silence. It's really in the silence we get everything, isn't it?
Yes. It's often in the things that people don't say.
Yeah, and it's just that quiet time. Somebody said something, or I read it somewhere. I know in the last couple of days it was interesting. And it went something like, you know, each time you open your eyes, your entire life is recreated again, because at that moment your life started. Every second that's gone by, that was the past. You can't live backwards, and you have to live forward.
That's very wise.
Yeah, I can't remember where it came from. Now, by the way, what caused you, what triggered you to write Questions in the Silence?
Well, I've always liked to tell stories, and I had started numerous books before that, but they never really captured my imagination in totality. So basically what I decided to do about 3 years ago is to write about two things that really take a lot of my passion. And one of them is psychotherapy, and the other is kind of looking to establish a spiritual way of life.
Okay,
and,
now by the way, when you talk spiritual way of life, what does that mean? And by the way, I'm all for that. We're on the same side of the table here when you talk about spirituality. But the point of contention is, what does that mean? Most people, it gets so far, Karen, beyond their grasp, the spiritual way of life. What does that mean? That I have to meditate all the time, and I become a psychic and a paranormal and whatever. And that's not really what it is, because you can apply it to your everyday existence.
That's absolutely true. And in my own life, the spiritual life means that the way I connect with other people and even animals and the rest of the world around me is one where I can kind of acknowledge that each of us is here for a purpose. And my personal view of spirituality is a way of connecting myself to that sense of purpose. I think it kind of transcends any particular religion. It can be found in any religion, but it's certainly a way of finding meaning in life.
By the way, isn't that what religion is supposed to be about? Finding purpose, you know, moving in the same direction, a collectiveness. And in and of itself, somewhere we got lost along the way.
I think you're right. I think that is the purpose of religion, and in its pure form, I think it still can do that for people. It's just that, you know, human beings sometimes can pervert things a little bit, and they can form institutions that go wrong. But I think the basis behind religion really can move people in the right direction towards finding meaning.
You know, there was a very interesting, it was a friend of mine years and years and years ago, and then some more years ago, who did a doctorate in theology, and he did a study in Spain and Spain and Italy and in those Romance countries, and he came up with something very interesting. He found that those countries, which happened to have been predominantly Catholic, the amount of beds in the mental wards were less than the rest of Europe. And I guess it came down to confession. They were doing confession. They got it out of themselves. They didn't have to externalize, and it didn't drive them crazy like most people get driven crazy today. So there's a purpose behind everything.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole idea of confession is, I think it's pervasive in a lot of religions actually today, definitely in Catholicism, also in Judaism. Although in Judaism, the confession is only once a year.
Yeah, and by the way,
it definitely does help people to talk about, you know, whatever they feel guilty about or where they have questions in life. And you know, Michael Ray, another place where it comes out actually is in psychotherapy. As a clinical psychologist, often I had to deal with those kinds of issues as well, where people are trying to find meaning in their life, and maybe they haven't found it through religion, but they need to find it in other ways by affirming other values they might have.
Sure. And I think one of the greatest ways to find it, and we've started to lose it, Karen, is in the family. There's got to be that connected, that connectiveness in the family, that acceptance in the family, so you create what's called identity. And most people running around, you can't get purpose unless you know who you are. And if you don't have that rock-solid foundation behind you, it can get very confusing out there.
Well, that's definitely true. I am very much centered in a family of my own. I have four grown children, as it turns out, and you know, they keep me centered. That's for sure.
Yeah. And by the way, we're talking about confession. You know, being Jew, and I happen to be Jewish, but once a year, that was something in the old days. If there was something that you wanted to express, don't tell your mom. She'll get you for it.
Well, now it's kind of the reverse. I think grown children tell their moms a lot of things.
Sure. No, absolutely. No, and I got it loud and clear. And I think that's realistically what it's about. And I think the magic word you just said was connection. That's what most people today miss. And I'll bet any amount of money, and I'm not a clinician, but I'll bet any amount of money, the majority of people that come in to see you, the biggest problem is, and before you uncover it with them, is a lack of connection, a disconnect from whatever it is that they're longing to be, to feel, or they want.
That's definitely true. I see a lot of people that don't know how to form relationships with other people. Some people even have problems forming a relationship with a pet, believe it or not, you know, because they've been so damaged in their early childhood. And, you know, it's interesting, in the novel, even though it is fiction, a lot of what I explore are those connections among family members and how they're formative, how the main character, Ari, has a deep relationship with her mom and dad, and how that really kind of makes her relate to her own patients in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely no question about it. And I, you know, the other thing that I've seen in family also, that the difference between the genders, male, female, the roles that you play. I remember my sister and I used to talk about. We still do talk about this all the time. I love my mom. That was, you know, thank goodness, you know, she's passed away in 1993. In 1993. And there was never any woulda, coulda, shouldas after she went. We were completely and totally complete with that. And so was my sister. But the point was that if I were to describe her and my sister sat next to me and described my mom, we would be talking about two completely separate women. And I really believe when it comes down to it, you're going to have that kind of a relationship in families.
You know, I'm not sure that's totally gender-based, however, because I have four kids, and all four of them have a different view of who I am. Because a lot of times they'll sit down, they'll discuss, oh, remember when Mom did this or that, and the other one will say, that's not how it happened, and they all see our interactions through a different lens.
Oh, sure. Now, I have to qualify something. I came from a world when you went to a movie and there was a bedroom scene, the law said one foot had to be on the floor. Doris Day Rock Hudson. So it was completely.
And they different. Always had two single beds as well.
Yeah, got it. Yes. Okay. Not that you remember. I got that part. But when it comes down to it, it was a different world, and the transition has been very different. Also, the women were this, and girls learned to do this, and boys learned to do that, and that was that world. That world doesn't exist anymore. And I sometimes look out at the world. Yeah, and I look out at the world sometimes and I think it's so confusing. It was so simple then.
I think it was simpler, but I think unfortunately for women and for men at times, they weren't able to achieve what they wanted with their lives. You know, women were kind of limited to what they could aspire to, and men weren't taught that they could nurture other people and that they could pick up a small baby or change the baby's diaper. You know, and I think both genders have benefited to a large degree by a little bit more openness. I think the only time it poses a problem is if women feel that they can't stay home to nurture their children because of pressures to be more than a mom. And to me, being a mom is the most important role. Other ones can be added on, but you can't ever deny the importance of a mom and her child.
By the way, Karen, I'm going to prove what you just said about women not being able to move forward and whatever. I have in my hand is the Milk and Ice Cream Drivers and Dairy Employees Union Local 225 Dairy and Ice Cream Agreement, 1964 to 1967. This is real. I have it in my hands. Page 77, just in case you ever get a copy. Article 15, and it says female. The employer shall not employ female help on any identical operation as now performed or heretofore performed by male help. So, yeah, you bet that was going on.
Yeah, definitely but was.
But they said if a man had it, a woman couldn't do it. And realistically, yes, it was. And I think there's a tremendous amount of confusion. That's why when you get into, quote, unquote, the title alone of your book, The Questions in the Silence, we are so busy today. There's so much noise today that no one actually sits down and gets a little bit of silence.
You know, that's absolutely true. I think people are almost afraid of silence. And that's one of the things I talk about in the book is that this young woman, Ari, has to learn not to be afraid of silence, to tolerate it, and the emotions that it can bring forth.
Yeah, no, but how much, and by the way, most authors would go through the same thing when you really come down to it. Ari Rothman was basically who you were inside. It has to be. You couldn't identify with it unless it was you somewhere in some degree.
I think you're right. I think in any good book where there's an honest feeling to the message in the book, that there's a large part of the author within it. Of course, Ari is definitely fictionalized. She can do a lot of things that I can't do. I can only imagine. But, you know, there is that base. Her motivation is very similar to my motivation in becoming a psychotherapist. And I have to admit that I also have been a seeker in life, trying to find ways to make things more meaningful.
Yeah. No, by the way, absolutely, and there's no question about it. One more question, and we're starting to run out of time. And the question is this. I pick up the book, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? Karen, what do I, Michael Ray, get to walk away with after I've read this book?
What do you get? Well, I guess you find one person's way of making meaning in their life, but then it's more than that. The other thing that you find is that every time you do something in your life, there are multiple determining factors, and you have to kind of dig deeper to really even understand your own motivation. And readers so far, they've communicated when they found the parts where the therapist was growing, and they said, gee, that made me wonder about why I do things and why I relate to my family in a certain way. So I think not only is there the entertainment of reading the book, but there's also learning a little bit about seeking self-knowledge.
Yeah, no question about it. Hey, by the way, we're out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book at and find out more about you?
The easiest way to buy the book is through Amazon.com, but I also do have a web page. It's called BellaLunaVoiceCompany.com.
Okay, BellaLunaVoiceCompany.com. If anybody missed it, they can go right to the Dresser After Dark website. It's going to be up there for a long time. Karen, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, and thank you, Michael Ray, for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Second dee 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 dee
Welcome back. I'm Michael Way. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I have all these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that.
Patty is with us. She's the author of Retro Age, Four Steps to a Younger You. She's 75 years old and is living as a living example that beauty, sexuality, and spirituality are enhanced with age. She's a holistic life coach specializing in anti-aging and sexuality. She's been featured in Dolce & Gabbana ad for Vogue, Vanity Fair, Harper's Bazaar, and W, and has appeared in CBS News, Inside Edition, the Discovery Channel, and she's got several books also. But the one we'll talk about tonight is Retro Age, Four Steps to a Younger You, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Looking and Feeling Younger. Hattie, I welcome to the show.
Thanks. That music was great, by the way.
Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you. Hey, by the way, when you really come down to it, age is nothing more than a state of mind, isn't it?
No. Age is a lot more than a state of mind. Sorry to start this off with a no.
Oh, this is good. Okay.
I used to say, the
gloves are on. Go ahead.
I used to start my lectures off by saying people talk about age as being just a number and being just in the mind, and then I add until you look in the mirror.
Okay,
so
no question.
So I have found that by being really open to what about age really bothers me, rather than being just gracious about accepting it, as soon as I really looked into what about it really bothered me and what was unacceptable, then I was able to do something about it. And that involved a lot of stuff with the body, the mind certainly, spirituality certainly, but real work with the body.
So. Now, by the way, and I totally agree with real work with the body. There's no question about that. And the more you work with your body, obviously, the younger you're going to feel, the way you're going to look, and the better you're going to experience life. But there are times when, you know, thoughts, you get up in the morning and, oh, a little pain here and a little pain there, and you don't want to go to work out, and you talk to a friend of yours, and you say, God, how did I get this old so quick? So actually, it's the way you think about it also to stimulate you to do the things you're talking about.
Right. You're right, yeah. Michael. So I actually talk about the power of negative thinking, meaning that if you can actually acknowledge and not be afraid of your negativity, because it's a real observation. If you're in pain, you're in pain. If you're exhausted or you're tired or you don't want to move, those things are all real. But rather than thinking of them as negative, I say, well, I guess this is one more way I have to be motivated. And I kind of, instead of battling it, accept that. And then I say, now what can I do? I don't push myself. I wait for an answer from my body.
Yeah, no question about that. And there are times when if you listen to your body, and I truly mean listen to your body, you'll know when some kind of a physical activity is just going to be too much for you, and you don't do it, and you gauge yourself. I am about 6 years younger than you, so I'm not 20 years old anymore. I'm 20 and 20 and 20, and it's growing. Okay. But the one thing that I've learned, I'm a product of the 50s, and if it hurts, you suck it up and you keep moving. But that's a mindset that doesn't exist too much anymore.
And I think that's good. That pushing through the pain is really not a great idea as one gets older. And not just because you've aged. It's because that particular wisdom that teaches you that you have to listen to your body. Now, sometimes people will accept wisdom over fitness and sexuality. I'm not one of those people. I love wisdom, but I like to couple it with vitality and youthfulness and sexuality and dancing and all those vibrant things. However, I don't push them. And that's the difference. I'm not exhausted with pushing myself to be younger. I find the youth within me, and it's always there.
Now, by the way, I want to talk about the word sexy for a minute. I would venture to guess,
sure.
I'm going to go right back to the beginning. Isn't sexy a state of mind? Isn't that, I mean, obviously, your body's got to be in a, you know, certain tune for whatever. But isn't that all the way you feel about yourself? Isn't that a state when you walk out of the house and you feel it? You got to feel it to be able to be it. And if you feel it, somebody else does too.
Well, Michael, on that I'll say yes.
Good. One for one.
Great. Because from that point of view, I date quite a lot. That was not particularly my intention. It's my joke. I'm a cougar, my cross to bear. But I do date quite a lot. And I also, in my holistic practice, counsel women that they are not to approach a man or themselves with feelings of discontent. They are to find what they cherish and love about themselves and focus on that. If you keep focusing on what you dislike about yourself, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you turn guys off, and you turn yourself off. Not good.
Yeah, and that's something
that I really agree with you.
Oh, by the way, and that's something I really believe, that you don't have to say a word. You walk into a room or you sit down with somebody, and if you're feeling that way about yourself, they're going to know it. They're going to feel it also, and not a word has to be said. And that person who could have been that great time you had, and I don't mean for one night, but it could have been forever, will walk away from you.
Michael, I totally agree with you. A man really wants a woman who is confident and loves herself, really does. There's something about women that they don't want to love themselves. They somehow think that that's a vanity, or there's something wrong with loving yourself. But if you're a spiritual person and you think of yourself as a child of God or whatever, even if a person is an atheist, they're a gift to the planet. We all are in our own way. We're different species of flowers and gifts to the planet. And we really have to train ourselves. Self-love somehow in adults does not come naturally. And so that's one of the things you do. My four-step program is EASE, E-A-S-E. So it's eating, which, of course, is very important. Attitude. And that's what you're talking about, Michael, that attitude, that feeling about the self. And I have something called Hattitudes because my name is Hattie. And it has a lot to do with how you view yourself, how you feel about yourself, and what you communicate. And you want to give yourself as a gift to the world. It's a lovely, lovely thing to do. It's not vain. It's not conceited.
Yeah, and by the way, I love what you say. The opposite of old isn't young. It's new. And that's realistically what it is. Every day you walk out there, it's got to be brand new. You can't, you know, if I say this 1,000 times a day, I really believe this in my heart of hearts. You cannot live backwards. You can't live in the past. And I think that's the biggest problem that most people have. They look in the mirror and they don't see what's going on now. They see 20 years ago. And that's not going to do anybody any good. It's called move forward. Create it if you want it. It's up to you. And I really believe everything you were talking about.
Perfect what you're saying. Yeah, you can't go back and be who you were. And besides, you shouldn't be thinking of being who you were. You should think that the person who you were evolved into the person who you are, and that you'll keep evolving. And that's kind of a wonderful thing. That's why I wouldn't have surgery or anything. I don't want to look like the person I once looked like. Not that surgery ever does that, by the way. But I really have quite a lot of curiosity about what nature and self-love and appreciation and service to humanity, what look, what expression that's going to put on my face and what beauty that's going to give me so that I can impart that beauty to the world.
And by the way, you cannot give, not you in the general sense of the word, you can't give anything to anybody that you are not or don't have yourself. Hattie, if you don't love yourself, if I don't love me, how am I going to love you? It's not going to happen. So realistically, it's got to start there. Most people think that they should live their lives for someone else and through someone else. Doesn't work that way. Because if you're not the best you can possibly be, what somebody's going to get is a deluded you, and it's going to be miserable.
Perfect. And not only that, women who will be dependent on men. If you're dependent on a man or anybody else to affirm you, they're going to feel pressure. Because they're taking all their energy to love themselves. I say that your first youth, your first beauty is a gift from nature, but your lifelong gift is a gift from yourself. Your beauty, your vitality, your sexuality, your contributions to humanity, your joy, these are things that you generate, and that's the gift of time. You give those to yourself through time, and then you share them with the world, and the more you put that out in the world, actually the more beautiful and sexual you become. Because to me, sexuality has a lot to do with vibrant energy, and energy makes the world go round.
Well, you know, I completely agree, because every morning after I shave and clean up, as I'm walking out of the bathroom, I look in the mirror and I wink and I say, "You are cute."
Well, you certainly sound cute to me. That's wonderful. And the face that looks back at you says, "Yeah, I agree with you, Michael. You're awfully cute." Yeah, and not only that, you have good taste and good judgment.
and also every once in a while says, "I like what you got on today." So, but when you really come down to it, if you think so, nobody else will. And as simple as that sounds, that could be the magic for most people out there. You got to be able to like what you see in the mirror.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, now we're starting.
When I first moved into this, yeah.
Go ahead. Okay, so we're.
When I first moved into this apartment, I called my son and I said, "Oh, honey, this place has a beautiful view." He says, "Really, Mom?" I said, "Yes, it's completely mirrored." And it is.
And why not? You know, and really, when it comes down to it, why not? Because, again, if you don't think you are, I'm going to use an example that I've used probably 10,000 times. Radio Susie just fell off her chair and says, "Oh, here it goes again." God asked me, ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Michael, are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. That's the key. If I could possibly do this, and if I had five women that were standing in front of me right now looking at me, and if I had the ability to go behind each one and look through their eyes and see me, one or two, they would look, I'd be gorgeous. And to somebody else, I'd be homely. To somebody else, I'd be plain. You can't please everybody. Uh-huh. So when you walk in front of that mirror, wink and say, "You are cute today," because the people who think so will always think so. And the people who don't, there's nothing you can do to get them to change their thinking.
That's right. And Michael, why would you want to contend with five women?
Good point. You only want
the one or two that have good judgment and appreciate you. But that appreciation comes from the self. And years ago, I bought a very, very expensive jacket. And in it, I looked like much more like the celebrity that I've become, because I'm on TV a lot now, and I wasn't in those days. I bought that jacket, and it was very outstanding and very unusual and very flamboyant. And I said to my friend, "If I wear this jacket and I compliment someone, they're going to think, wow, that compliment is coming from that woman." And what I have learned from this so-called vanity, which isn't vanity, if you cherish yourself and you look beautiful and you radiate beauty, when you acknowledge someone else, they feel great and they start feeling better about themselves. Because there's some people you just can't say, "Love yourself." But if you say, "I really think you're beautiful. My, you look marvelous," which is what I do pretty much all day long in New York. It's a walking city, and people will stop me. They say they saw me on television, and I will go up to them and always find something wonderful. "Oh, your hair is beautiful. What glowing eyes you have," so that you impart a sense of loveliness and self-appreciation to other people from your own power of self-appreciation. So that's one of the gifts that time has given me, and I'm really happy about that.
Hattie, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you and find the book and everything else?
Sure. The book is Retro Age, Four Steps to a Younger You. That's eating, attitude, skincare, and exercise, and it's got pictures in it and everything, and that's on Amazon. My webpage has blogs on it, and that's www.holisticallyhattie.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
And thank you so much. It was delightful.
Good night.
You're really good looking on the phone.
Yeah. You know what? Two of us think so now. Good night.
Okay, good night, dear.
Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Patricia Evans with us, the author of Victory Over Verbal Abuse, A Healing Guide to Renewing Your Spirit and Reclaiming Your Life. She's a nationally acclaimed consultant who has written the first guide to identify verbal abuse and show step-by-step how a victim can free and begin to heal with affirm affirmations, techniques, and advice on professional help. She's the founder of the Evans Interpersonal Communications Institute, whose work has been called groundbreaking by Newsweek magazine, and is the author of four best-selling books that have helped millions of people live happier, healthier, and abuse-free lives. Patricia, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much. I'm very thrilled to be here. For some reason, I'm getting a little bit of an echo.
Ah, okay. You know what? They'll handle it. The board. I can hear them on it right now.
There, it's already.
Ah, they're so good. We have magic.
I think it's going away.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about.
No, I still hear.
Ah. Okay.
But it's okay. I think I can do this by just not paying attention to the echo.
Okay, it'll go away because they're really good there. At the network.
Are good.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
they are.
Okay.
Now, let me ask this question.
Okay.
One of the things that, that we talk about with verbal abuse, you talk about warning signs. Can people be verbally abused and not know that they're being verbally abused?
Because most people will think of verbal abuse as like cussing and swearing, you know, or some really vicious name-calling. But and anybody could say something that defines somebody and then say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. You don't look that great today. I meant, you know, I'm just really cranky. And oh, okay. So they resolve it. Now, in a verbally abusive relationship, one person, in one way or another, is constantly defining the other person, but at the same time, there's no resolution. So it's a pattern in the relationship. And so if, let's say somebody says, gosh, you're stupid, you don't know anything. And then the other person says, hey, you know, don't call me stupid. This, you know, I'm really intelligent. I have a very high IQ. And they say, oh, now you just want to argue. No, don't tell me what that I want to argue. And then it goes on and on and on, you know. And there's no resolution. There's just a constant kind of slam against the other person's thoughts, way of being, what they do, what they say is always, it's never right. They're never good enough. And it's so One of the things about it is that combined with this, they will hear things like, oh, I really love you, nobody could love you like I do, you know, and that kind of thing. And so they're getting double messages all the time. And one of the most common abusive sentences is, you're too sensitive, like you're made wrong. You're trying to start a fight. Like, I live within you. I know your soul. I know your motives. You're trying to start a fight, which is the last thing the person who's targeted by verbal abuse is trying to do. They're always trying to resolve the relationship. They're always trying to explain, no, I'm not trying to start a fight. You know, I really just brought this up because it really hurt me when you promised to call and, you know, if you were going to be late, and it was 3 hours. And I was so worried about you with all the fog out there and the snow and stuff. So whatever. And then they said, you know, well, you're just trying to argue, you know. And it goes on and on and on and on. But so explaining doesn't work. And usually the person who's experiencing this becomes more and more confused. They don't think, gee, I'm being told what I am, what I think, what I feel, what I want, what I'm doing, and so forth. This is crazy. This is silly. This is nonsense. You know, they're not thinking that. They're thinking, I've got to get this other person to understand. I wasn't trying to start a fight. I don't want to win, because they might be told, you want to win. And I wasn't thinking this, and so on and so on. So they're constantly put on the defensive. They feel that they have to explain so they can have a good relationship. And they try to explain what they were doing or thinking. And the other person won't listen to that in any way, shape, or form. In fact, a verbal abuser usually can't really hear the partner, isn't really curious, what's bothering you? What didn't you like about that joke? Instead, they'll say, you don't have a sense of humor. You can't take a joke. And so it goes on like that. And so the person that's the victim or target of all this abuse feels more and more like they're not good enough, that they must be saying something wrong, that they must not be coming across right. They will try to meticulously figure out how to express themselves. They may have sleepless nights trying to figure out how they can say something so that their mate won't say, now you want to argue, or now you're trying to start a fight. And the key that I want our listeners to know to dealing with this is to address the real issue. Hey, Mr. or Miss, it sounds like you're telling me what I want or what I think. You know, this is nonsense. Please don't do it anymore. I don't want you to pretend to be me or pretend to be God and know what I'm thinking or what I want. But please ask me nicely with your happy voice if you're really angry. You know, how about asking me nicely? What do you want, or why does this bother you? So,
Patricia, let me hold you up for a minute, because I'm listening very closely to you. Early on when we talked about, you know, does somebody know that if they're being abused? Let's bring it to the other side. Do people actually know that they're abusers? I see this going on constantly with people, the interactions back and forth, and somebody's always got to say why and explain themselves and all the good stuff. But these people who are the abusers, do they even know they're abusers?
People who are doing it, you know, they really do not see themselves as abusive. And for the most part, you know, let's say 95% do not see themselves as abusive, and they don't do it because they feel entitled and that they get to do it just because they get to do it or anything like that. What they feel, and I have interviewed, well, I've actually consulted to over 1,000 people and talked with over 30,000 over 20 years, and I hear from people every single day, a number of people. And I can tell you from what I've learned is that they usually feel irritated or attacked, more often sort of attacked. And I want to give you a real example, but first I better say that usually the person who indulges in verbal abuse is, it's like they have a lost self. They're warm, receptive, emotionally intelligent, gentle, sensitive self is just kind of knocked out of them. Maybe their father toughened them up. Maybe they were told, you know, you're never going to amount to anything, you're being a wimp, you're being a baby. And so they just had to block off their feelings and emotions, or they couldn't survive as a child. So usually they have a lost self, and that whole lot, it's a lot of parts of them. It's their emotional intelligence and their ability to be receptive and so forth. That lost self is, you might say, projected into their partner. So, you know, if they're standing next to their partner or somewhere, they feel fine. They feel whole and complete. If they know where she is, they feel fine. It's like the rest of them's in the kitchen cooking or doing something. They feel just fine. They have a very perfected persona. They usually appear really friendly and really nice to everyone. Everyone says, oh, you're so lucky to be with this person. But behind closed doors, when there's no audience, it's almost like this other self emerges in this abuser. And the rest of him is maybe in the kitchen fixing dinner and maybe asks him a question. Do you have any plans for the weekend? Plans? What do you mean plans? Do I have to have plans? Why does he explode? Okay, there's a lot more to that story. But anyway, he explodes because the rest of him already knows if he has plans. So it's like he's lost part of himself, and he feels pushed away and rejected, and he will form a confabulation. That's a kind of explanation for this huge feeling of being attacked. And it's an automatic thing our mind does, and we, like, somebody getting having a blow on their head and losing their memory of some sort, for some reason they end up in a store and they go, oh yeah, I came to get milk. They form a confabulation so they don't feel crazy. So he forms a confabulation, you know, it was the tone of your voice, or you're always questioning me, or you have to know everything. And she just is, usually it's a guy doing this to a gal, but not always, okay, but, you know, it's
Let me hold you up for a minute, because I think three things actually. One is that it's a shame that this absolutely has to go on, and it does. And I would say the majority of the population, the majority of relationships, everything you're saying seems to be what goes on, and they just don't have the steps, the way to move their way through it. So the question
is...
That's
why I wanted to give you the preliminary, that they don't know what they're doing and they're projected. So the way to address, there's two things that are important to do. One is to address this, not by explaining. That could go on forever. One woman wrote me 42 years explaining. You can't just forget about explaining if you can. And then say, when you hear anything that doesn't sound okay, a kind of universal, easy-to-remember response is just, what'd you say? Even if this person's screaming at you, oh, what'd you say? Just, oh, what'd you say? And then the person will say, you heard me, blah, blah, blah. And then you say, aha, that's what I thought you said, and walk away. Aha, that's what I thought you said. And laugh if you want. Unless the other person is physically violent or has a gun, you can do this, okay? And if you forget to do it and you start to immediately, because, see, the partner usually thinks that the abuser is rational. And it's kind of a myth, you know? And so they will think the abuser is rational. They think they can explain what they were doing, what they were saying. And I want to show you how unconscious this is. This is a very real, absolutely 100% real call I got. And it's beyond verbal abuse. It goes to the physical. But it does explain this difficulty that the abuser has in realizing that even when they know what they did, they don't know why they did it. So this man calls up and he says, hey, you're the author and all that? Yeah, okay. And he says, Now I know why I threw my wife to the ground. And I said, really? What happened? He said, well, it was like this. I got home from work early, and I love to cook. So I was cooking up a storm, had all the burners going. Then my wife came in from work, and she said hi, and I said hi. Then she looked down at the mail, and I went in a rage and threw to the floor. Now I know why. The rest of me, my lost self, was going to walk over the projected part. See, he'd read one of my books. Was going to walk over and say, can I help you with the cooking? And it's like in that moment, all he felt was, it's like half of him disappeared right before his eyes. This woman is looking at the mail, but where's his partner that's walking over? So it's all it's rather unconscious. But this is typical of a way to explain what's going on with these people. If someone says, hey, do you have any plans for the weekend? Why would this guy be so explosive? He's explosive because the rest of him already knows. So who's this asking him this, and where did the rest of him go? Right before his eyes or before his ears, you know, this partner is gone. So this is a dynamic that's explained in Controlling People. The first book, The Verbally Abusive Relationship, shows what the dynamics look like, what the partner's experiencing. And that's the one that Newsweek calls groundbreaking and so forth. And I did the Oprah show and all that. But then the second one shows forms of control, and the third one explains this pattern. And I've gotten a letter from a psychiatrist who said, we need to get this into psychiatric residencies and to counselors and therapists before we do more harm. Because you know how prevalent the problem is. A lot of partners will get their mate to come to a counselor's. And if this counselor is trained to say, if there's a problem in the relationship, it's a 50-50 thing. The partner walks away getting that kind of message, and what are you doing to provoke him? Well, I look down at the mail, you know. But anyway, if the partner hears this message and all, the partner can feel complete despair, feel suicidal. Several women I've talked to had committed themselves to mental institutions so they wouldn't commit suicide because they had tried and tried and tried and tried to explain that this wasn't okay, what was happening, you know, that they weren't trying to start a fight, that they just asked about these plans and so on. So it's a real, you know, in a way it's simple when you really get what's going on here, but it's also a huge problem. I mean, thousands and thousands of people, as you said, you see it in half or more relationships. And it's very common, and yet that's why we've got half or more marriages ending. You know, we don't need to have this in our lives anymore if we can wake up enough people to this problem. It was never even named as a verbally abusive relationship from Sanskrit to 1992. No, had no name. It was like, well, he's very taciturn, that's why he doesn't talk to you, or, you know, well, she's got her hands full with those kids, no wonder she's angry, or, you know, there was just, it was just ignored. It was basically ignored, and yet it's a prevalent thing, very, very prevalent. So,
yeah, Patricia, let me hold you up. Wait. We're starting to run out of time. There's another way to handle this whole thing. And let me do this, and then I'll get your website.
Okay.
Go ahead. And I would drive a verbally abusive person nuts. Go ahead and call me stupid. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Hey, you're so stupid.
I'm really good at it. I practice. Yeah, there's nothing... You hear it.
Yeah, so if you said you practice, I'd say, okay, so I, pretending we're doing this, I would say, oh, you do. You're really good at
I am wonderful at this. I'm even going to go to school for it. But the point is, it's called diffuse it. And that's really where the key is. There's so many people out there that fall right into it. They play into it, and they get controlled by all of it. And that's where the problem is. Now, with that... Do you have, and we are running out of time,
well,
have a website?
Nothing justifies abuse, so I would never blame the victim. I would never blame the victim, because if I said I, you know, see, the point is, I don't tell you I love you every day, and then say, well, that was really stupid, I heard you on the show. You'd say, well, what did I say? You're likely, if you thought that I loved you and we had this fantastic relationship, and then every now and then, you know, I said something like, in all sincerity, you know, hey, I heard you on the show. Man, that was a goof up. You'd say, what did I do? You would play into it because it's in the context
of a relationship. It's called, that's what you work with, and if you goof, you goof, and so what? With that, do you have a website we can find yet?
Yeah, well, it's not like that. Not when people commit themselves to institutions. It's verbalabuse.com, and it's the destruction of relationships. And, of course, if somebody's raging at you and they're telling you they will torture your children if you call the cops, and there's so many millions of things that are more than just, hey, you goofed up, you know. It's verbalabuse.com. It's life and death for many, many people.
I got it. And we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay,
good night.
Bye.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Sharon Heath with us is a writer of fiction and nonfiction, a Jungian analyst in private practice, and a public speaker on themes ranging from the place of soul in social media to gossip, envy, secrecy, and belonging. And she is the author of The History of My Body. Sharon, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. When we talk about different, and I want to start it with that, there are so many people, quote unquote, who are different out there, and they're really not. And a lot of it would come down to the lack of somebody stepping outside themselves and looking at somebody else first to see if there's a problem or not. So let's start at the beginning and let's say, laying a base and say, Sharon, what is different? How do we define that?
How do you define different? Well, I like to use the word unique. And I'm very comfortable with each one of us being different in the sense that I think that we each were born on this planet to contribute something very particular. And so I see each one of us as potentially having something quite unique to contribute. And so I look at differentness through that lens. Part of what I do in the history of my body is I'm telling the story of a young girl, or she's telling her own story, who you could say have some traits of an Asperger's child. She whirls and flaps. She has some difficulty with social cues. She's preoccupied with one topic. In her case, it's God and what she calls the void. But she's also very much her own person. And once she encounters people in her life who are able to kind of take in the wholeness of her and see her potential, she's able to use what somebody else would look at as a disability or a differentness and really contribute to the culture at large.
Oh, absolutely. We take kids with ADD, those who really have ADD. Mm-hmm. In their own sense, there's a brilliance in there that sometimes gets covered up because they are quote-unquote different or it goes unnoticed. And I think that in and of itself is where the problem is. It's
I'm totally with you in that, and I think that, you know, obviously some of us have conditions that do need some treatment, but that doesn't mean that we aren't whole and full persons that's much larger than whatever that condition is that needs a treatment. And that's the trick in life, is to kind of find the largeness of who we are.
No, but the other step beside that is finding what it is that the problem is. We usually work on a problem we don't have as opposed to the one that we do have, and we truly never get anywhere. You know, whether it's Asperger's, whether it's autism, whether it's ADD, whatever the case is, if we can get the professionals who really know what they're doing and zero in on what the real problem is and be able to work with it in that fashion.
Well, that's certainly been very true with kids with autism. It's taken a long time for kind of science to catch up with what's going on. And there are coming up with all kinds of lovely treatment modalities for kids who have autism. In the case of Fleur in my novel, she's what we would call a very high-functioning autistic child, if you want to call her autistic. She's a high-functioning Asperger's child. And in her instance, her so-called treatment comes from the kind of mentoring and understanding and the insight of some very sort of perceptive people that she's lucky ultimately to encounter.
Now, by the way, you're a Jungian analyst, and one of the things that I remember from all of Carl Jung's work that stayed with me, and I got it maybe, 20, 25 years ago, and what he said, we talked about assumption. Assumption gets taken on as an incontestable conclusion because you can't find an answer to it. You can't prove it wrong. You take it on as fact. You live your life based on assumption, and you get into a lot of trouble. And I think that's what many, many people do today. They assume something. They can't prove it wrong, so now it's fact, and that's how their life is lived.
And isn't it wonderful when we have a life experience or a series of experiences that open us up?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I'm with you on that one. Part of what I do in my private practice is I put a lot of stock in dreams, and very often what I find is that the dreams will help open up the world beyond where the assumptions are of the person, of the dreamer. And that's part of the function of dreams, is they kind of crack open those assumptions as you're describing them.
But also, aren't dreams symbolic? You know, most people take a dream on as literal. Mm-hmm. But if we begin to understand the symbology of the dream, then it begins to open up in a language that's understandable.
Exactly. But it does take a while to kind of learn that language. And each dreamer has his or her own language as well, which is why sometimes it's useful to do an analysis where you can begin to learn your own dreamer's language.
Sure. I remember the greatest example of that, there was a guy a long time ago, and the dream went something like this. He walked across a railroad track, and then he urinated on the other side. So what could you possibly make out of a dream like that? But when it broke down, his own personal symbology was the railroad track. The tracks are stiff and rigid. They do not bend, and urination is waste, and he was wasting his time by not being able to, you know, bend enough to see life the way it really was. So if we take it literally, it doesn't mean anything, but if we break down the individual symbology, all of a sudden the messages are unbelievable.
I love the synchronicity of what you're saying, because I'm thinking about that image of urination, which, if you read the novel, it actually plays a role in the story. But, you know, another way to think about urinating is it's about expression and self-expression. So, you know, you might also look at that dream as somebody kind of crossing over beyond their assumptions to the other side of the tracks and learning how to express themselves.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. But the words came from this particular person we were talking about. So that wouldn't have been somebody giving you an explanation of what it meant. That came from him.
Yeah.
And that's where the key is. There's an old, what is it called? There's an old acting, it's a process that they use. And let's say, for instance, that you have to become something. I'm a chair. What am I? You know, and you break it down, you break it down, you break it down,
yeah,
and you get the symbology of it for you personally.
Yes, absolutely. one of the things that I find about writing fiction is that you're a bit like an actor, and that you get to get inside these characters and really discover the world from their perspective.
Yeah. Now, by the way, where are you in this story?
Where am I in the story? Well, you know, I think that any fiction writer will tell you that they're in every character. There's just no way around it. I think if you're wide open to what begins to emerge from you, you can say, wow, I didn't know that was inside me, but holy cannoli, there it is.
Yeah, no question about it. And realistically, it to be that vulnerable is power. And when I say power, if you're that vulnerable and you say, okay, this is what it is and this is what I experience, you can't use it against you once it's out in the open and it doesn't, you know, and you've taken the power.
I'm so with you on that one.
Yeah,
I love that image of vulnerability as power. It's so counter to how the collective tends to think of power, but that is absolutely true.
No, absolutely. And I really believe, and I've found this for years and years and years, what you think you're hiding is what people see and control you with. So if there's anything in there, you might as well bring it out because they got it anyway.
Nothing wrong with having your 2 feet on your own ground.
No, I completely and totally 1,000% agree. And please understand what I'm going to say next. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we lived in a world that you didn't have any clients?
Well, you know, the work that I do is really about self-discovery, and I think that's one of the things that I've treasured about doing Jungian work, is that Jung looked at people's wounds as actually the doorways to their potential. So if somebody has anxiety or depression or whatever they're struggling with, it's actually an opening into, as you say, a way to re-examine assumptions.
Sure, but isn't that a disconnect? We wouldn't be having all these emotional problems if we were getting truly what we wanted. But if you don't know what you want, you're always going to be missing it, and it doesn't come from outside, it comes from inside.
Yes. It comes from inside, but, you know, there's an interconnection in the world. Sometimes I think we make this false split between what's inside and what's outside. That's part of what I actually explored in the story. Is that my young character sort of makes a lot of discoveries. She has to be taught how to kind of be in the world. That's part of the Asperger's part of her personality, is she starts out pretty naive about social cues. So she has to kind of learn how to be in relationship. And in the process of learning how to be in relationship, she's also learning about herself. So it's sometimes we learn about the world, and that teaches us about ourselves on the inside. Sometimes we learn about ourselves on the inside, and that makes us more at home in the world. I think it goes both ways.
Oh, no question about it. And when it comes from inside, you've got to have that spark of recognition to be able to work with it and become part of it. If you don't have that spark
of
recognition,
sometimes it takes a little poking around in order to get there.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. No question. If it was that easy, then nobody would be running around lost. And I really believe that in my heart of hearts, when it comes right down to it, that what causes this problem is what we fight about ourselves. We fight that what we are inside, and too many people are frightened to death to look. Better unhappy than unsure.
Yeah, and of course, sometimes when we look inside, it takes a while to kind of get unified. We can have conflicting desires sometimes.
Yeah. No question about it. But when it really comes down to it, if I pick the book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover, what do I, Michael Ray, get out of it? What do I take away? And forget gender, because any book transcends gender. There's something, when you really get down into who we are, that spirituality, it doesn't really matter. What do I walk away with? What do I get that I didn't have before I read the book?
I think one of the things that you get is the gift to us of our failures and our doubts. One of the things about this story is that nothing that Fleur discovers that is of any value, and nothing that she gives to others that is of any value, comes but through failures at achieving some things that she desperately wants to achieve. So one is the gift of failure. The other is about how we are all very unique, but we're also interconnected. One of the images that popped up to me as I was writing the book was something that comes out of Hindu mythology called the myth of Indra's web. And the Hindu god Indra supposedly had a heaven that was comprised of a web where every intersection of threads had a jewel suspended from it, and every jewel in the web reflected every other jewel in the web. So one of the things that Fleur discovers is that we're each a unique jewel, but we're also very interdependent and very connected with one another. And it's through that confrontation with failures, doubts, and also this sense of profound interconnection that ultimately she finds her way into sort of a self-acceptance, a forgiveness of others, and real true love, self-love and other love. But it's really about that failure, I think, that is crucial.
You know, I wish they would throw that word out the window.
It has such negative connotations.
Yeah, because the failure in so many cases is the best thing that could ever happen to you.
Yeah.
You know, it forces you to change your direction. It forces you to take a look at your life, and you go through whatever it is that you have to go through until you move through it. But the failure is a very powerful thing, and if we could take another word for it, I would venture to guess, and I won't ask anything personal, but I would venture to guess that every time that you came up against something in your life, quote unquote, that you called it a failure, that you got hurt or taken back, you know, 4 or 5 years later, whatever the case may be, as you matured, you got older, you looked at it, it was the best thing that happened to you because it allowed you to help you to make the kind of decisions that you make today.
Not just the kinds of decisions, but also opening up the imagination. It's just like when you butt up against a brick wall and you can't move, it's as though something in you wants to get moving. That's when the imagination comes in. You know, when I was a kid, I was a pretty depressed little girl, and I thought I had no imagination. And it was actually in kind of exploring what was causing that depression that liberated the imagination that helped me ultimately write fiction, which is just such a joy. It kind of opened up one of the greatest joys in my own life. So I'm a big believer in the power of the human imagination. That's part of what also I explore very much in the novel, is this little girl has a very kind of profound curiosity, and she has an imagination that takes her into all kinds of places over the simplest of things. And it's through that she comes up with ultimately some world-changing discoveries, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think imagination, I'm going to probably use the wrong word, but it's the fertilizer. It's that whatever it is that allows whatever you're going to be or do grow or what you've got for someone else.
Fertilizer is a great word for it. It helps things grow.
Yeah, absolutely. And without it, I think we would all be in a lot of trouble right now. And when you really come down to it, I think the message is it comes down to this, that it's okay to be you.
Yeah. Not just okay, it's a gift.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it came wrapped, and unless you see it. But so many people, they need to unwrap that gift because there is nothing more powerful in the world than the gift of yourself. And if more people would get that, we would have less problems on this planet and this country.
No kidding. I know. We live in a rather troubled world.
Tell me, and look at the... Look at the Prozac sales. You know, mm-hmm. We shouldn't have to have that.
Yeah.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Sharon, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. I'm at www.sharonheath.com.
And where do we buy The History of My Body?
You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Barnes & Noble. You can find it in e-versions, print versions.
And I love every second of it. Hey, by the way, Sharon, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been a total pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Well, that's all. That's all.
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You were listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. We're going to talk about the modeling industry, the talent industry tonight. Jacqueline Quinzel Miller is with her, CEO of City Model and Talent. She's a modeling and a casting powerhouse and owner of the New York-based City Model and Talent, who often books her clients for large-scale events throughout Fashion Week, commercials, music, videos, and a lot more. She's got strong views about what the modeling and talent industry has become over the past few years and wants to share with inspiring talent realistic expectations. As the industry grows and changes year to year, she wants to, and we will, discuss with the public the following topics, and as we get into it, you're going to hear it. Jackie, hey, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Jackie, when we look at talent and modeling today, let's take modeling. Modeling has changed over the last 10, 15, 20 years. As a youngster coming into it, what do you think someone should be looking at and expect? What's the mistakes they make that cause them not to be able to be everything who they can be in the industry?
Well, basically, the misconception is that it can happen as quickly as the snap of your fingers, and that is 1,000% incorrect. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of dedication. There's a lot of research that the individual needs to do on the company that they want to have to market them, whether it be a scouting company like myself or if they go to a licensed agent company. Every city deals with this industry completely different. The laws in New York are completely different than the laws in Florida versus the laws in California. The best advice really is to do the research.
Okay, now, by the way, image is so critically important, and there's issues about image. An image changes constantly based on culture and what somebody's going to pay for. What do we deal with image today? How do we define that in such a way that those that are in the industry or getting into the industry can wrap their arms around and really understand how to create and work with it properly?
Well, the best thing that a person needs to do is they have to feel 110% comfortable in their own skin. And if they are confident in the way that they want people to see them and how they perceive themselves, and that is how they're wanting to be casted, then they shouldn't have to change for anybody, no matter what the industry as a whole tries to put out there or how much one can get paid by changing their image. I mean, I think that is a terrible thing that the industry has this negative cloud over everyone that gets first signed. They look so different, and they get, you know, blonder or more Caucasian looking or thinner, or, you know, they have to have some kind of surgery to look something that targets the grand media, which is totally incorrect. And it's something that I'm trying to change, because what I like to do is with my clients is use the everyday woman and man, because those are the people that purchase the products. You know, I once told somebody that I deal with clients that more look like Hondas versus Ferraris, if you could kind of understand that analogy.
No, and by the way, absolutely. I give you a prime example of that, and I think that's brilliant in the way that it is. I have been a bodybuilder for, 50 years now, and if I go into it, and I'm no Schwarzenegger by any stretch of the imagination. I like to keep in shape. Now, I walk into a gym, and I got pictures of Arnold all over the wall. Well, I've set myself up for failure as I walk into it, because I'm never going to get like this guy. So then I go to another place, and on the wall, there's pictures of guys that I know I can get myself like. Now I'm in, I sign up, and I'm ready to go. And I think that's realistically what you're talking about. You get some of these women, or some of these guys are absolutely gorgeous, right? And they frighten people because they can never look like them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that is that number one misconception, where they look on television or, you know, on the movie screen as you have to look this way, you have to be this way, and that's not the case. You know, there's a whole market out there. Some of them is more sensationalized than others, but there's a tremendous market out there that markets every type of individual, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of gender, and regardless of size in itself. You know, it's just more companies, hopefully, like myself, that can become the bigger companies eventually with time that will market to those everyday type of people versus that one cookie cutter that we so-called see on a daily basis.
Now, by the way, I'm going to tell you a secret. Don't tell anybody. This is between you and I. My sister lives with me, and she's got all of these Women's Day magazines. You know, I've been reading these. I want to pick up a magazine, and what I've got is I've got Women's Day, Woman's World, whatever. So every once in a while, I glance through one of the magazines, and very interesting, and I see it today, and I didn't see it years ago. You got women in there that are modeling that are size 15, 18, 20, whatever the case may be, and it opens it up to everybody. It's not just the very skinny little model anymore. It's what you were saying earlier. It's what everybody can relate to. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the best way to give confidence to these young girls who, at the age of 9, maybe even some of them even earlier, age of 6, they're looking through magazines and they're seeing, you know, one style, one cookie cutter, and they think that, oh, that's the way I need to be. And if I'm not, then I'm not going to be popular. I'm not going to be, you know, invited to the party. I'm not going to be able to get this job. Or, you know, it plays with their confidence. And that's something that I'm trying so hard to do with the industry and with the market and the castings that I'm getting, is to change that outlook.
And something very important also, teen images. You know, in today's world, you got so many of these kids that are, you know, they get themselves, they're not mature enough to be able to deal with life the way life is, and they get themselves in trouble. I've watched Miley Cyrus, and I've watched her from this little innocent thing. Now all of a sudden she's a sex symbol, and it's a little too fast. The transition may not be what a lot of the kids are looking for today. And if she is a role model, then those kids are going to follow along exactly with what she does and how she says it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole different ball game, to be honest with you, because once you're so immersed in the industry, you have to have a greater hold of what it is that you want to put out there. And with that being said, a lot of that is with the parents, and the parents really need to kind of be strict with it. But again, the factor is, you know, the confidence level of the child, and then also it's the check, it's the paycheck. The paycheck pays for the road to people changing the way that they are wanting to be perceived, whether they're a role model or not. Teenagers need to realize that people are looking up to them, and even though they're changing themselves, if this is the industry that they want to be in, then they have to make the smart decisions, because they are public figures. And everything they do is going to be in the public, no matter what the scenario is.
So that's why, see, Jackie, that's why I feel that they need somebody like yourself. Let's say if I was a teenage model, I'm 14, 15, 16 years old. Now I'm becoming 17, 18, I want to transition. You can't just do it overnight. It's a strategy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is. And I have a lot of clients that have been with me when they were around 13, and now they're hitting 17, 19 years old, and they're constantly asking me questions, hey, what is the right path for me to go this way? Or can you do the research, because so-and-so contacted me and they want me to come in for an audition. I really don't know much about them. So I definitely have a lot of teenagers and parents of teenagers who reach out to me and ask for my advice, because, you know, with the years that they've been with me, they know I have their back no matter what, and I will do the research to make sure that they are 1,000% protected, because they are my database, my clientele, and I have to make sure that I'm branding them the right way, not just for themselves, but for my company and, you know, for my name.
Now, if some of the kids that you know, they have the talent or they think they have the talent, how do you find out? I come to you and I say, I want to be a model. How do we break me down, quote unquote, to see if I have the wherewithal, to see if it's something that I really want to do, or in what facet of the industry that I truly belong based on what I'm presenting to you?
Well, it seems today everybody wants to be a model. You know, they don't realize what it takes to truly be the model or the talent personality. You know, so what happens is we have a scout that goes to different, you know, areas in which that person or that scout is actually told by me what I'm looking for by the agent's castings that I'm getting. So if they're looking for a 15-year-old Hispanic boy, that's what we're looking for. That's what we gear into. Now, you know, she could scout 10 Hispanic boys, but I then have to have them come into my office to be interviewed and evaluated to see if they, you know, meet the due diligence and all the criteria. You know, are they going to be professional? Are they going to be on time? Are they going to be with a great attitude? Because, you know, you're in one personality when you're with your friends, and then you're a different personality when you're behind a desk or with your parents. We have to see if this person is, you know, can they transition the personalities amongst the situation, or are they just unprofessional, no matter what, and disrespectful? So there's a couple different steps that they have to take other than, hey, I want to be a model, hey, I can sing, or I want to act. There's so much more in depth that goes into it.
I think there's another area of consideration that most people don't even think about. Because if you're going to, quote unquote, take one of the kids under your wing, and they're going to get where they're going to go, obviously, it's not something that they would know how to do themselves. You're going to have to hold them by the hand, quote unquote, till they got through there. But the other thing, the other something we want to throw into the mix is the parents. You got to teach the parents too, because if those kids start to get a big head, it's going to be very hard for those parents to be controlling them at home.
Oh, yeah, and sometimes the parents have the bigger head in the very beginning where they think their child is the best thing since sliced bread, and it is very difficult to, you know, give them that reality that every child is wonderful, but, you know, we have to see what they can offer to the industry and what the industry can offer to the individual. So there is a lot of schooling, not just with the child, which is difficult in itself, but it is with the parents to kind of bring them to, I hate to say it, like almost reality, as it's not going to happen as quick as you think that it can for your child because you saw them in a play in the auditorium of, you know, the elementary school and they shined. That's just a stepping stone. There's so much more out there, and there's so much, you know, competition out there. So it's definitely knowing that you can have 20 doors be closed on an opportunity, but it's the 21st door that can be that great opportunity that could take you to a wonderful future in this industry. It's just knowing that it takes a lot of legwork and a lot of people to believe in them. And, you know.
Yeah. No, by the way, when you have somebody come in, obviously you sit down and you do a consultation. Can they find you through the website?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of my leads do find me online, and my website is citymodelandtalent.com. Every word spelled out. I'm also on Facebook, which is facebook.com/citymodelandtalentfans. And, you know, and then obviously you could contact my office, which is 631-232-0400, your New York-based company.
Wonderful. By the way, if anybody missed it, because it went by pretty fast, it'll be up on our website for somebody to follow up on. Jackie, hey, listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show tonight. There's so many kids that need it. Kids, forget it, adults that need this kind of information and hand-holding, because the industry is getting bigger and bigger than it used to be. And my goodness, there's times when they get out there, they may have the talent, and if they don't know where to go, the whole thing's been wasted.
Yeah, it's right, Sue, and I really do appreciate you taking out the time to talking to me, and I hope whatever message I put out there, some people are understand it, and if there's anything I can do, they can contact me. Again, my company website is citymodelandtalent.com, and I look forward to hearing from those that are out there.
Wonderful. Hey, Jackie, thank you, and good night.
All right, take care now.
Good night.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Out as friends. Tears and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.